Okay, brethren, we're continuing to look at a few other topics before we get back at some point to the book of Isaiah. And recently we've talked a little bit about the fact that you and I can expect to go through many tribulations on our way entering the kingdom of God. Tribulations, problems, difficulties, storms of life might be work-related for some of us. Maybe health related, might be some problems, difficulties within our families. And nowadays it could especially be issues, troubles, problems even within the church, the people of God. And we can expect these storms. We saw that last week. And it's fairly common for us as human beings not particularly to look forward to unpleasant experiences and storms. We often meet them with some anxiety, some trepidation, some downright fear. And that's natural, but for you and I, as God's people, as His redeemed, it's not really necessary for us to meet troubles that particular way. And last week, if you were around, we spoke about the need for you and me to have an established heart. A heart which is secure, fixed, does not easily move. And associated with having an established heart, there's one other sort of concept or understanding that I think can help us all, and it would surely make life easier for us. We'd be more comfortable if we were absolutely, totally sure, absolutely convinced that we had a powerful protector, a super being, invincible, right at our side in every situation or circumstance we faced. If we knew, and really, really, really knew that we were never going to be alone, well, that would probably help us meet situations with a lot more comfort, much more assurance. And the answer, of course, is that we do actually sort of know that. But then again, this is a physical world. Our trials, storms and situations are so very real to us that it's quite easy to forget that we have a great companion who walks with us. And sometimes, without meaning to, we lose sight of this powerful being who walks with us day by day. And if we do lose sight, then that can really adversely affect us. So today, I'd like to sort of really help us encourage ourselves, perhaps gain some comfort if necessary, and just remind ourselves fairly simply of just who is with us every single day, 24/7. And that makes no difference whether you and I are in some ghetto in a big city or in some, you know, dog kennel in the Ozarks. Wherever we are, we have a supernatural companion. So I entitled today's Bible study, Our Supernatural Companion. And let's start by turning to the Psalms. Psalms number 139. Psalms 139 and verse 1. Psalms 139 and beginning in the first verse. And here we read, O Eternal, You have searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. And David's bringing out what you and I probably do know, which is that God knows. He knows when you're going to recline in your easy chair to watch the TV. He knows when you're rising up to go off to the refrigerator to get a glass of water. He knows when you're setting out the door to go and take the dog for a walk, and He knows essentially what you're doing and what I'm doing. He says, you know my sitting down and my rising up, and even it says God understands our thoughts from His far off distance. So what you're thinking, not a secret to God. He is, in that sense, that close. Verse 3, you comprehend my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word on my tongue, but behold, eternal, you know it altogether. Altogether in the sense of not only does God know the words, he even knows what we're trying to say with them. Because we don't always succeed. Sometimes our words are not quite appropriate. Our intentions are good, but sometimes awkward words come out. But God knows it all. The words and the intent. He is, in that sense, able to keep an eye on you and me and know our plans, our thoughts, our words, our sitting down, our rising up. We are not somewhere, whereas God is looking somewhere else. We're not, in that sense, alone. You might think that there's some situations where God's unaware, doesn't know, cannot see. Well, David says that's not the case. God, because he is God, and his abilities are clearly way beyond our comprehension, God knows us. That might be comforting. It might be less comforting, depends what we're up to. Verse 5, you have hedged me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. And I'll agree with that. I have no idea how God can understand all of our thoughts of, you know, billions of people 24/7 every second. I can't fathom that, but he does. And that's good to know, and provided, of course, that we'd be happy that he does know our thoughts. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? Is it possible to escape God's attention for good or bad? Well, the answer is no. And I'm thinking today of when you and I are meeting circumstances, situations, difficulties that just really stump us, and we have no idea quite what to do next. Can we even survive this particular problem? But of course, actually, we will never be alone, because there's no place that you and I can go, either inadvertently or even deliberately, that we can elude, escape the watching eyes of our God. If I ascend into heaven, you are there. I think it says heavens in the Hebrew. So no matter where you would go, you know, up into the sky or out into space beyond you know, Jupiter or Pluto or somewhere. If I make my bed in hell, you know, the place of the dead, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, you know, way beyond the horizon, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. So, for good or for bad, I suppose if you're doing bad things and God was after you, so to speak, there's no point trying to run. But it's actually talking more about, in a sense, that God can help us, support us, reach us anywhere, heaven, hell, in the midst of battles. Doesn't stop God. He knows our thoughts, our plans, our situation, our circumstances. He's conscious, he's watching, he's aware. Verse 11, if I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, well, even the night shall be light about me. Indeed, the darkness shall not hide from you, but the night, for God, shines as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to you. So he just brings out a number of situations, that whether you're traveling a long way off, North Pole, into space, into the depths of hell or the earth, whether it's darkness, God will never lose sight of us. He's totally aware of what we're doing, which is very, very comforting, because we should never think we're hitting any situation or difficulty on our own. We have a companion with us at all times, and a very, very able companion who cannot lose sight of us, no matter what would happen to us. And of course, bearing that in mind, looking at verse 23, David says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my anxieties, and see if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. You know, David had the confidence to say, since you have that knowledge, God, and there is no way of escape, not that he would want to, well, I'm confident to say, have a look at me. Look at my mind, my thoughts. They're good towards you. And for you and I, as believers, we ought to be able to be sort of fairly confident. We are frail, we are human beings, we make mistakes, we do still sin from time to time, but of course we can always run to God. I've said before a million times, don't exaggerate, Jamie, but almost a million times, when we sin, we should run to God, not run from Him. You know, keep short accounts with God, and then we get forgiven and cleansed, and really, we shouldn't be ever hiding or endeavoring to hide something from God, some part of our lives, because He sees. And we should be as confident to say, as David was, well, check me out, God. You know, test my heart, look at it. You know, see if there's any wicked way in me. You won't find one, I hope. If you do, by the way, you know, please let me know. And then David would correct it, and so should you and I. But the point here is that David makes it very plain. You and I will never be anywhere where God is unable to see us, to hear us, or to reach out and to help us, which is really very, very encouraging. Look at Psalms 23. We all know this one, Psalms 23. All about shepherds and things. Psalms number 23 in verse 1. I guess this is the most famous of all the Psalms. I think there's three versions of it in the purple hymnal, if you still use that. Psalms 23. Eternal, or the Lord, is my shepherd. I shall not want, meaning I shall not lack. I shall have no lack. Well, that's quite an encouraging start. You know, many people in this world are concerned and anxious about having to do without, having to go hungry. But the psalmist says, the Lord is my shepherd, and He's going to be a pretty good shepherd. And a shepherd, a good shepherd, wouldn't allow his sheep, you know, to go hungry and have all their wool drop off and be scrawny, have a leg drop off over here and an ear drop off over there, hobbling along. I mean, if a sheep wandered off on its own, that might happen to it. Then along comes a wolf and gobbles it up. But if the shepherd was around, you'd expect a good shepherd to have a good, healthy sheep. That's his responsibility. And here the psalmist is saying that's what God is like. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want or lack. He makes me to lie down in green pastures, not scrubland, chewing the bark of trees and so on. This is a good shepherd that makes sure his sheep have got plenty of good things. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. Verse 4, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Why? For You are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. So here's David, or it could be you and me, and we're walking through the valley of the shadow of death. It may not be a pleasant place. But are we going to be anxious, troubled, you know, the old fingernails are chewed to the bone? Or does it say here, yeah, even though I'm walking, at least temporarily, you walk into a valley, at some point you walk back out the other side. So temporarily, for a season, this person's walking through the valley of the shadow of death. It says, I will fear no evil. Why? Well, because You are with me, and Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. And he's talking about his relationship to God, or you know, our relationship to our God. And if you and I are facing evil or trouble or calamity, we need not fear. In fact, we could say, I will fear no evil, because I understand, God, Father, that You are with me. Your rod and Your staff, they provide me with comfort. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Okay, so we may have enemies, opponents, from human beings up to the devil and his lot. For it says, you prepare a table or a feast, one translation says, before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup runs over. You know, abundance. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And that's again encouraging. It's not a temporary situation. You know, surely goodness and mercy would follow me for, you know, a week or two, 3 days a year, but all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Eternal forever. So that's a well-loved psalm, because it is a very, very encouraging one. But just because it's a well-loved psalm, and people sing it all the time, and put it on cards, and memorize it, doesn't make it any less true. It is true. That is true truth. And you and I, if we're walking through difficult, you know, stages in our lives, should do what David does, which is to say, I will fear no evil, because I know who's with me. The great shepherd, the good shepherd. And he's going to look after me. He's going to lead me in good paths. He's going to take me to green pastures where I can be well nourished. I can be a nice, you know, fat sheep, not a scrawny one with bits falling off. And that's what you and I want, to be looked after by a faithful, good shepherd. And he is. If we turn to Hebrews 13 and verse 5, book of Hebrews 13, and verse 5, but picking up sort of halfway through the verse with the thought that sort of changes. So Hebrews 13, verse 5, and the latter part of that verse. For he himself, capital H, talking of God, has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me? So, I don't know what situations you're facing in your life, and of course vice versa, but whatever they may be, the scripture says we can have great confidence, because he himself has said, I will never leave you. I will not forsake you. And the Greek is even more emphatic than that. It appears to be a sort of a triple negative, in other words, repeated three times to make it really, 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 really clear. And you know, one literal translation of verse 5 says, I will not, I will not, I will not let you down. I will not let you go. So, you know, a triple negative, how can God be any more emphatic than to say something, you know, three times in one verse, I will not, I will not, I will not let you go. Or, as it's translated in the New King James, I will never, ever leave you nor forsake you. And because God has said that, and God is true, then verse 6, we may boldly say, and it does say boldly, but it's not something we just say, well, I'm just, you know, so humble, and I'm just a worm, and God's so mighty and great, and I just, you know, just really be very quietly. It says boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I choose not to fear. After all, what can man do to me? If God's on my side, I will not fear. And that should be very encouraging. It says boldly say, we may boldly say. Well, to say is to speak, or to declare, or to announce. So it implies, it's probably better not just to keep this inside us, in our mind just thinking, well, you know, God's for me. But to actually boldly say it. If we're facing an issue, a problem, a difficulty, why not say it out loud? It doesn't have to be to somebody else, although no harm in doing that if they're church people. In fact, although maybe not always the church people even, but certainly at some point just speak out loud. God is my helper. I will not fear. Because he said he will never, ever, ever leave me and never any time forsake me. And if that's the case, well, wouldn't that make a bit of a difference? If we're coming into situations or circumstances or storms are approaching, and we were fully aware that God has promised that he will never, ever leave me nor forsake me. And I can boldly say that. Let's turn to Psalms 27 and verse 1. Psalms 27. And verse 1. Verse 1, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Now, we could take this as just being just nice little songs tucked away in the Bible, little pretty platitudes, and so on, or we take them as being true. The Lord is my light. He is my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Whom or of what shall I be anxious? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Well, most of us hit situations and get nervous or sort of anxious or even downright fearful, contemplating things out there, or maybe at times people out there. But in a sense, we've got our eyes looking the wrong way, because we have a God. We have a Lord and Eternal who is the strength of our lives, and of whom should we then be afraid? When the wicked came against me to eat up my flesh, my enemies and foes, they stumbled and fell. Though an army should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this I will be confident. So how do you fancy an army after you? Well, if it did, and of course there's possibilities there might be some end time prophecies are tucked in here, because certainly getting towards the very end of the age, it's quite likely there might well be an army after God's people. But if that is how this works out ultimately in a prophecy, again, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this I'll be confident. Verse 4, one thing I've desired of the Eternal, that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Eternal all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Eternal, and to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the secret place of his tabernacle he shall hide me. He shall set me high upon a rock. Well, okay, in time of trouble here and now, God will hide us. In the secret place of his tabernacle, he can hide us. He will set us high upon a rock. And at the end time, if we're looking at the troubles and you know, Satan causing all the chaos, he will at the end time, and the beast power and the false prophet, well, there's a possible hint here of a place of being hidden from those end time difficulties. But primarily I'm just focusing on the here and now. Verse 6, and now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me. Okay, there are enemies, but we're victorious. Therefore I will offer sacrifices of joy in his tabernacle. I will sing, yes, I will sing praises to the Eternal. And why not? Because despite armies and war and enemies and foes, they all stumble and fall. And this person who looks to the Eternal as his support, this person emerges on a rock, victorious, and singing praises. Turn back to Psalms chapter 3 and verse 1. Psalms chapter 3 and verse 1. Lord, how they have increased who trouble me. Well, that sounds like bad news. You know, having one person troubling you is bad enough, you might think. But here's David, and he's saying, wow, look, they're multiplying. You know, from the east and the north and the west, here they come. Lord, how they have increased who are causing me trouble. Many are they who rise up against me. Many are they who say of me, there is no help for him in God. And so you and I may have opposition from more than one direction. You may think, this is getting worse. You know, last year I had all these problems, this year I've got twice as many. But you, O Lord, verse 3, are a shield for me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. And that's what you and I want, is this companion this supernatural companion who's always there with us, who's never leaving us on our own. If you and I were left on our own, we're sunk. Doesn't matter how good we think we are. But you, O Lord, he says, verse 3, are a shield for me. You're my glory. You're the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill, Selah. And in consequence, I lay down and slept. So, some people lie awake all night, you know, just anxious, cold sweat, reflecting on all things that could go wrong, and in great detail, and living them out over and over and over again. You know, fingernails long since gone, or getting up and heading off for the whiskey bottle, because, well, you know, stress, strain, difficulty, circumstances, can't cope. But here's David who says, you know, many of those are after me. My troubles are multiplied. Ah, so I went to sleep. Verse 5. Why not? Trouble's been given to the great God, our supernatural companion. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. Verse 6. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Why would you be? If God's on our side, and he's our companion, and he's our good shepherd, and he's our refuge, does it matter whether it's two against us, or 202 million against us? You know, you, or me, plus God, is a majority in any situation. So, you might think it's hard not to be fearful and anxious, but actually, Scriptures make it plain that you and I should just sort of roll over and go to sleep when facing difficulties. Right, of course, we get, you know, we're walking with God. Clearly, if God's not really part of our lives, other than 1 hour or 2 hours per Sabbath, then okay, there's perhaps a bit of work required there. But, you know, God says that he'll be with his people. And if he was with David, well, don't forget, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today and forever, hasn't changed, not into favoritism. And we can see some fairly good illustrations of how people face difficulty with confidence. If you look at Daniel chapter 3, the book of Daniel, chapter 3, and picking up in verse 8, which I think is partially into the story. Nebuchadnezzar has sort of moved on a bit from his vision of this great statue of gold and silver and bronze and iron and feet of miry clay and so on. And a bit later he's built his own super-duper statue, all of gold. And he wants everybody to bow down and worship his great golden statue. So we pick up the story in verse 8. Therefore at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. That's the instructions. That's the edict from Mr. Nebuchadnezzar. Well, verse 12. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, otherwise known as shake the bed, make the bed, and into bed you go. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. That's for children, by the way, not adults. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up, which to Nebuchadnezzar was an affront, because he was obviously a sort of quite a powerful man, a powerful emperor, and what he said went, ought to go. If he shouted, jump, he shouted, how high, sir? And so I was leaping up in the air. Verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. And of course, these were young Jewish men, friends of Daniel. It seems evident that Daniel wasn't around at this point. He was in charge of Babylon as a whole, so probably in some journey one imagines, and not able to rein back Mr. Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods, or worship the gold image which I have set up?" And he was, upset. And he ought to have been wiser than this, because he'd heard his dream revealed and its meaning a few years earlier from Daniel. But I guess memories had faded a wee bit. Verse 15, "Now, if you're ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you should be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God then who will deliver you from my hands?" Which might be him being just plain stupid and just sort of saying, maybe Daniel's God can reveal dreams, but I'm the man in power here. If you don't bow down and worship, see that burning fiery furnace, well, you'll be in there, boys. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." Which I think in today's vernacular would be, what's the point of talking to you about this? Not going to happen, not necessary. "If that is the case," in other words, there's more than one way of reading this, but I'll present this particular option. "If that is the case," in other words, you throw us into the burning, fiery furnace, "our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning, fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king." So if you do throw us in, our God can and will deliver us. So, to you, Nebuchadnezzar. "But if not, if you don't throw us in, because you feel, perhaps, a minor bit of respect for us and our stance, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. So if you relent, forget it. Either way, whether you do or don't, we are not serving your gods. We're not going to worship your statue. So there, stick it." Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. They'd really dismissed his instructions, and even if he was thinking, well, these are top men, and maybe at the end of the day they'll relent. Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. So he was a bit angry. And of course, you can see that there was a temptation here, probably for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to have given in. They're facing what appears to be, certain death. But a way out, if you accept and bow down and worship, all you do is just compromise a little, boys. And of course, you and I sometimes are facing perhaps a fiery furnace type trial. Temptation to compromise never works, does it? I think they said somewhere that what you compromise to get, you will lose. You and I are not supposed to be compromisers. And why would we be if we have a great supernatural companion who sees us wherever we are, knows our thoughts wherever they are, can be with us wherever we go, is our refuge, is our light, is our salvation? Why would we compromise? To compromise means that we don't actually believe that God will do what he said. So we're going to rely on our own abilities, our own planning, our own sort of intellect. It won't happen, won't work. So these guys thankfully did not compromise, and Nebuchadnezzar blew his top, wall of death. And so heat that thing up 7 times more, if that was possible. And he commanded certain mighty men, verse 20, of valor, who were in his army, to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and cast them into the burning, fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, including probably their mobile phones, and were cast into the midst of the burning, fiery furnace, the lot. And therefore, because the king's command was urgent or harsh. He wasn't very patient, and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This was some blaze, and you're carting off these three guys towards it to toss them in, and in they went. But the heat, the flames were so, you know, fierce that these guys were, you know, frizzled on the way up. So there's a bunch of dead soldiers there, plus of course adios to these three young Jewish men. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, this Hebrew way of writing can be quite repetitive. I think we know the names by now, but in they go, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So I guess arms and legs all tied up, tossed in. You think that's the end of them. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. Booms, hang on, something strange there. He rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? And the answer said to the king, true, king, which I always tend to chuckle at that point, because Nebuchadnezzar was clearly a rather powerful man in a complete rage, busy burning people left, right, and centre. And they said, oh, true, king, what do you say, oh, king, true, king? If he'd said something like, isn't that Donald Duck down there? They said, oh, yeah, true, king, is Donald Duck. Look, and there's a Shuey, Huey, and Louie with him. So, verse 25, look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. So, not bound any longer. There's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego walking about in this intensely burning fire with a fourth individual walking about. So they were not alone. In their case, there was a supernatural companion with them. And they were walking, and for all I know, they were busy talking in there. Now, I guess we don't know for sure if that was the Lord Jesus Christ or an angel. Certainly a supernatural being had joined them. And so they did not compromise. They said they'd be delivered by their God, and they were. Verse 26. Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, in case we've forgotten who they are, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire, and the satraps, administrators, governors, king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. And I guess if you think of the end times, if any of God's people had to go through nuclear fire, here's a good illustration that can be done. Carrying on, on whose bodies the fire had no power, the hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and incredibly, the smell of fire was not on them. So the soldiers had been burnt to a crisp a bit earlier, but these three guys, because only three seemed to walk out, and the fourth has now disappeared, not even the smell of smoke on them. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, and Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel, as he saw, or an angel, and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they frustrated the king's word, and yielded their bodies, that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss, because he did earlier, against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, because he wasn't converted, as you'll notice, and their houses be made an ash heap, because there's no other God who can deliver like this. Then he promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So a great outcome from three guys who would not compromise, put their trust in God, and God was there for them, and will be there for you and for me in our burning fiery trial. Look at Daniel chapter 6, and picking up in verse 4, Daniel 6 and verse 4. Daniel's back in town, and Nebuchadnezzar is sleeping with his fathers. Darius is now around. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault, because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Daniel was a man of supreme integrity. Most men in high government seem to yield to some element of corruption, but Daniel, you know, pure. And these guys were looking for anything. You know, the journalists were out and they were spying on him and got their binoculars and intercepting and hacking into his PC and his mobile phone, but no, can't find anything at all. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." Because they know that he keeps that law. And that's, again, commendation of Daniel. So if we can find something that he'll have to keep that goes contrary to the king. So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators, all that bunch, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions," which probably appealed to Darius's vanity. "Oh, what, me, the only person? Oh, well, I like the idea of that. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter." Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. He'd been succored by his top men, as he found out a bit later. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees, a good way to pray, three times that day, and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. You know, Daniel apparently prayed on his knees three times a day. Of course, and he was also ruler in effect over the entire empire, so you and I, who generally are not ruling empires, shouldn't really make too many excuses about being too busy, because Daniel managed it. And then these men assembled and found Daniel praying, probably CCTV camera in the corner, and making supplications before his God. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. "Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions?" The king answered and said, "The thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which, of course, does not alter." You can't change one of these laws once it's been established. So the answer said before the king, "Well, you know, that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah," which was decades earlier, "does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day." And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself, because he saw that he'd been ambushed by his top men. He set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to find, you know, some loophole, some small print. Shows you that Daniel was highly respected by Darius, as he was previously by Nebuchadnezzar. And so even though the law had been sort of broken, Darius recognized it was all a plot, a conspiracy, merely to nail Daniel, get him tossed in with the lions, and now Darius is trying to find some way that I can wriggle out, but couldn't. Verse 15, "Then these men approached the king," you know, pushy lot, "and said to the king, 'Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians," you know, which you're required to follow yourself, "that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed." You know, you're stuck. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him to the den of lions. But the king spoke into Daniel, not with much confidence, I think, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." But I think he got his fingers and toes crossed at the time. "Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. So here's Daniel. He could have compromised and said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll just stop praying for a while. I mean, I can sort of pray in my head. But Daniel says, no, I sort of prayed towards Jerusalem. I've always prayed this way. I'm not going to change my relationship with my God just because of some threat from a king, an emperor, or some plotters. And so he carried on. No compromise, but now he's doing good, and he's in trouble for doing good. And sometimes I guess you and I can be. We're doing the right thing, like a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, doing the right thing, like, say, Daniel, and we end up in trouble. We're not always in trouble because we're doing bad things. Don't forget, Satan goes about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And sometimes it's Satan's behind these things, as it probably was here. Verse 18, now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. So he's a king, all right. He's got musicians, symphony orchestras, the finest DVDs. He's got plasma screen TVs. He's got everything you want. But he eats nothing and maybe drinks nothing. And no musicians were brought before him because he's totally upset, probably somewhat angry, but certainly deeply distressed that this great guy Daniel, who has his total respect, is now being probably chewed up and spat out by the lions. And his sleep went from him, just lies awake, chewing his fingernails. Then the king arose very early in the morning, no long lies, and went in haste to the den of lions, because he's in a hurry now. This may be possibly, who knows, Daniel's a great guy, perhaps his God could do this, but that's unlikely. But let's find out. So he races off. When he came to the den, he cried with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, are you there? Has he been able to deliver you from the lions? And he probably waits, and a second passes, he's been chewed up. Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. Then the king was exceedingly glad for him, and I guess he was probably skipping about, gets the guys to shift the stone, and they take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, even a few teeth marks, because he believed in his God. Can God look after you in a lion's den? In a burning fiery furnace? Have the uttermost powers of the sea? In the heavens? Under the earth? Yeah. And so in this particular case, the poor old king lay awake, sleepless, and probably, I suspect, Daniel just with his head back and snored. So he was more comfortable in the lion's den than the king was in his palace. And so the angel was there. I don't know whether the angel sort of stayed for a while. It kept the lions quiet. Maybe he sat there and talked to Daniel through the night. Doesn't say. Verse 24, and the king gave the command. You don't really upset these kings without a consequence. And they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions. Them, their children, and their wives. And the lions overpowered them, and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. Not sure how many lions were there, but sounds like a goodly number, maybe a couple of dozen or something. And so these guys got their comeuppance. And Daniel carried on assisting and governing and so on. And it's not that Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego or Daniel were some way super special. You and I are God's sons and daughters. We're his family. God will look after us the self same way. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 4, second letter to Timothy, chapter 4 and verse 9. You and I just have to be conscious and maybe even work at it to be conscious that we have a supernatural companion who is with us, we're not ever on our own. He said he'll never leave us nor forsake us. 2 Timothy 4. Now here's an illustration of Paul suffering some severe disappointments from people around him. Verse 9, be diligent to come to me quickly, for Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and has departed for Thessalonica. Plus Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus is off to Dalmatia, only Luke is with me. So Demas in particular doesn't get a very good rapport there. He's been seduced by the dark side and cleared off. And others have left for probably better reasons, but poor old Paul says there's only Luke here at the moment, which is him and me. Well, get Mark, verse 11, and bring him with you, Timothy, for he is useful to me for ministry. Tychicus I've sent to Ephesus. Also, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas when you come, and the books also, especially the parchments. Verse 14, Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. May the Lord repay him according to his works. You also must beware of him, for he has greatly resisted our words. So you could say that's Alexander being, marked. Note this man. He's trouble. Verse 16, at my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me. May not be charged against them. So Paul's just been through some quite difficult times. At his first defense, by the Romans, he said, they all left me. I guess Luke perhaps was around, but the rest, some had gone for good reasons on certain messages they were carrying. Others, like Demas and Alexander, were just causing trouble. And here's, an aging Paul, and at times he's on his own. At my first defense, verse 16, no one stood with me. They all left me. And sometimes I might feel like, all my sort of colleagues and friends and spiritual family, they've all beetled off somewhere. Verse 17, but the Lord stood with me and strengthened me. One translation says, poured power into me, so that the message might be preached fully through me, and that all the Gentiles might hear, and I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion. Not quite like Daniel, I suppose, but out of the potential being thrown to the lions, or he may be talking of the emperor, but he was delivered. And verse 18, and the Lord will deliver me from every evil work and preserve me for his heavenly kingdom. To him be glory forever and ever. Amen. So Paul is sort of saying the contrast here. Well, some of the human beings have deserted me. Some have turned against me, like Alexander, and been a real problem. Others fled when the Roman emperor stood up. But the Lord stood with me. He poured out his power into me. And the Lord will deliver me from every evil work and preserve me. So in a sense, Paul knew where to look. He had that assurance that, God was with him. And even if people at times disappointed and wandered away, God was always there. And of course, if we ever forget that, and forget that God is there for us, then we could get really disheartened. And part of the problem that you and I have, I guess, is we know we're weak in ourselves. We're insufficient to meet most battles in ourselves. And so when trials or difficulties or storms sort of head our way, we tend to get a bit anxious. And we forget we're not supposed to be leaning on ourselves, but rather relying on God who is with us to strengthen us and to never leave us nor forsake us. God will always do his part. 1 Peter chapter 1. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 1. And verse 3. 1 Peter 1 verse 3. It's not for us to look at our own assets and if we're really strong in ourselves, we feel confident, and if really weak in ourselves, we feel terrified. It's not us. We won't be able to overcome. We don't have to fret about that. Verse 3, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled, that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. And of course, you and I have got a great hope. We do have a great inheritance that's not on the earth. It's not going to rust or corrupt or get stolen. It's reserved in heaven for us. Verse 5, who are kept, how? Well, by our own strength? No. You and I are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. That's when, of course, true salvation comes, when Jesus returns and we're born again and become spirit beings, immortal. But how are we kept? We're kept, or one translation says, protected, as a military guard. God protects us. He acts around us like a military guard. You and I, verse 5, are kept by the power of God, not our own power. We haven't got it, so no point in just checking ourselves and saying, I've looked at my inventory of special powers and I've got none. Yeah, fine, okay, that's great. We wouldn't be able to overcome anyway with our own superpowers. It's like God's power. In this, verse 6, in this salvation he's talking about, you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials. But of course, they're temporary. That the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though be tested in fire, may be found to praise, honour and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom, having not seen, you love, though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, or the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. But in all of that, kept by the power of God through faith. And that's God's responsibility. He's the one we fly to for refuge. Look at Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 10. Hebrews 6 verse 10. Here we read, for God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you have shown toward his name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. And we desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end. Be completely assured that you do not become sluggish, but imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. We've said before, faith and patience are the two power twins. You need faith. We need faith. But faith that lasts for a minute, or an hour, or a day, or until the troubles mount and then fades away, isn't much use. The faith has to be held up with patience or constancy. The faith just stays and stays and stays and patiently stays until it achieves its end. So faith and patience allow us to inherit the promises. For when God made a promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, surely blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply you. So he wanted to convince Abraham, as we thought, well, I'll take an oath. On what? Well, nothing else really. I'll take an oath on myself. Not that God required to make his word stronger, but he was trying to reinforce in Abraham's mind that this promise is absolutely for sure. It will never change. And so, after he, Abraham, had patiently endured or waited, he obtained the promise. For men indeed swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is for them an end of all dispute. Thus God, determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things, unchanging things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us. So, Paul, if that's who it is saying, God promised, which is really good enough because he's God, but actually he went beyond that. He took an oath, swore by himself, You get his promise, his word which can never be broken, plus if that wasn't good enough, you know, God stretched it even further and actually took an oath that he would deliver. And so he says, verse 18, I'll read this in the Amplified. This was so that by two unchangeable things, his promise and his oath, in which it is impossible for God ever to prove false or deceive us, we who have fled to him for refuge might have mighty indwelling strength and strong encouragement to grasp and hold fast the hope appointed for us. Verse 19, this hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which enters the presence behind the veil, where the forerunner has entered for us, even Jesus, having become high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Verse 19 says, this hope, you know, God has promised twice that we have this hope as an anchor of the soul. What does an anchor do? Well, an anchor doesn't slip. It keeps a vessel or a ship from moving. So the picture here is of a, you know, ship on the sea, and the storms come, but it's got an anchor. And that anchor is solid and strong. It says here, this anchor is sure and steadfast, verse 19. And our hope in God, our confidence in God, and his promises and his oath, is such that you and I need never waver. The storms can come, but we have an anchor, and we don't move, because this anchor is based upon Jesus Christ and God's promises. So in a sense, the storms are not going to move us because we're securely anchored. Any situation in life, any circumstance, any set of problems, any threats, no, we're anchored. We have a steadfast heart, and we're anchored by our hope in God. Nothing in that sense, you know, can move us. And, you know, sometimes we see storms coming, of course. That's better in some ways, you can get out of the way. Sometimes we don't realize till we're actually in a storm. But it's good always to know that God is faithful. He is going to stand by us. We can have that anchor in our souls. But in a sense, you know, God is more than just faithful. I mean, that's good enough. He is also not just a faithful God, a supernatural companion, but he's also our friend. Not just a sort of a hard judge, you know, waiting to clobber us when we step out of line. That was a picture some years ago, a young woman in the church, a lovely young woman, brought up as a Catholic home, Irish Catholic home, which I understand fully, having an Irish Catholic mother, but you get a lot of nonsense there, and she grew up. Her picture of God was actually quite an injurious one. She saw God as a hard, harsh judge, given all these rules, and he was just waiting there, sort of around the corner. As you walked along, you'd break a rule, and he'd bounce out with his baseball bat, cricket bat, and bounce you over the head, teach you a lesson. That was her picture. That was really her picture of God. Hard, harsh, inflicting penalties willy-nilly. The laws were there so that you would break them, and when you did, boy, he'd come after you and get you. That's not a picture of the true God. God is our friend. Look at Proverbs 18 and verse 24. Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 24. And here we read, last verse in chapter 18. A man who has friends must himself be friendly, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And, you know, friends are sort of good to have. I think we'd all like to have friends, and many of them. And a friend is somebody who, you know, understands their frailties, and you know, is a person who's keen to help, able to help, and you know, provides that help. And it says here that there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And that's a true friend. Somebody who knows you and still likes you is a true friend, of course. And there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Perhaps some of us have got them, but there is a friend, the capital F, he will stick closer than any brother humanly ever could. If you look at Isaiah 41 and verse 8. Isaiah 41 and verse 8. Isaiah chapter 41 and verse 8. It's God talking, and he says, "But you, O Israel, are my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the descendants of Abraham, my friend." And that's really quite something. Here's many centuries have passed, and God's talking to his people, to Israel and to Jacob, and he says, "You're the descendants of Abraham." Yeah, true. "Abraham, my friend." Now that sounds pretty good, to have God say that you're my friend. And that is a good carrying on. "You whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest regions and said to you, 'You are my servant. I have chosen you and have not cast you away. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand.'" And verse 13, "For I, the Lord your God, will hold your right hand, saying to you, 'Fear not, I will help you.'" God's always there to help. But interestingly, that Abraham's referred to as God's friend. Only Abraham? Okay, let's turn to John 15 and verse 10. John 15 and verse 10, because actually you and I are God's friends. So we're not talking of some harsh being looking out for rule breakers so that he can bash them. We've seen already many scriptures in the Psalms. God is there to help. He's watching. He's following. He sees us. He understands us. John 15 and verse 10. "If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things are spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you, and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. You are my friends, if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all things that I heard my Father I have made known to you." So Jesus calls them his friends, and you and I are also. You know, Jesus is our true friend, sticks closer than any brother could, always there, knows, understands. He's a faithful high priest and a friend. And he's a true friend. Jesus has been here. You and I might think we're frail and make mistakes and get things wrong and panic and so on. Jesus was here. He walked the earth with his friends. Jesus has been tempted in every situation as you and I are, but in his case without sin. He knows what it's like. He's been here. He's got the t-shirt. Jesus understands, and despite what you and I do and don't do, Jesus still loves us. A friend is one who knows you and loves you just the same, as Albert Hubbard. And Jesus does. He knows us and he loves us just the same. And so you and I, facing up to situations, difficulties and problems and storms, we're never facing them on our own. Not at any time. God has said he will never, ever, 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 ever leave us nor forsake us. We can boldly say, say it, announce it, proclaim it. The Lord is my helper. Well, I'm not going to fear. And that's something that should be real to us. The catch obviously is we're most of us so close to this physical world, and all we see is what we see in the mirror, and the problems around us, and the invisible world we forget. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the cases where the invisible world comes to the rescue. And you and I must, in a sense, continue to look at God's word and develop that understanding that our God is a real God. It's not some stay away God. just leaving us like some experiment. You know, he starts it off, winds it up, and wanders off. The world is careers around in complete chaos, with the saints falling over left, right, and centre. And God says, "Oh, well, what happened to brother so and so? Oh, he died 20 years ago. Did he? Oh, I missed that. Oh, I thought he was doing rather well." You know, God is there 24/7. Let's look finally at Psalms 46 and verse 1. Psalms 46 and verse 1. And here we read, "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble." Well, it's been fairly consistent. I mean, there's been lots of scriptures we've looked at, and lots I've had to drop out, since I've been dragging about today. So I've had to drop three or four already. But they're all saying the same thing. You know, God is our refuge. He is our strength. He is a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth be removed, though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling, Selah. Now, maybe that's just the psalmist being, poetic, and nothing wrong with that. But of course, sometimes when you read these, you think, I wonder if that's also got an application at the end time, when the mountains literally will be carried into the sea, and the waters will roar and be troubled, and there'll be tsunamis and things. But irrespective, the point is that no matter what it is, whether it's a poetry, whether it's a literal, whether it's a here and now today, whether it's at the very end time in X number of years, God is our refuge and strength, our very present help in trouble. Therefore, we choose not to fear, because our good shepherd is with us. Verse 7, "The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge." In verse 11, "The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge." And, life will be much easier for you and me. Our heart can be more easily established if we recognize that God, the Lord Jesus, his angels are with us. Of course, we won't see them with our physical eyes, and we might think it would be a lot easier. Of course it would. But all that God does, he does by faith. You know, I have to learn to see, in a sense, by that eye of faith, and then believe. And ideally, and we can do this, but we can choose to live every day in the knowledge, the sure knowledge, that we have a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And at no time in our lives will we ever be on our own. We've always got a supernatural companion with us every single second of every single day, of every month, of every year. And knowing that God is faithful, and he is our friend, and he's on our side, and he's there to help us, and he's our refuge and strength, that ought to help us look at situations, circumstances, much more confidently. God is on our side. Okay, brethren, with that we'll conclude today's Bible study.